Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Today with Caleb. My name is Caleb Primrose, and I am joined with a very special guest today, Senator Zach Nunn.
Caleb, thanks so much for having us on the show today, and mainly thank you very much for all you do to help, you know, folks across our community be informed, be engaged, and to take pragmatic action to help, you know, themselves, their neighbors, their family. It's really important. So thank you, Caleb.
No problem. I enjoy doing this stuff. It's a great lot of fun.
Good.
So let's go ahead and just talk about a little bit about yourself. Whatever you want to talk about, what you want the people to know.
Yeah, no. So Caleb, one, we love serving our community. We grew up here. We're a Century Farm family in Iowa. My dad was a teacher at North High. My mom was a nurse down at what was then Methodist Hospital in the Des Moines area. We grew up just east of the fairgrounds when we were kids, and then switched over to Southeast Polk and Altoona when we were later in high school. I went to Drake University, which is a school in the Des Moines area here, and then had the privilege of serving in the U.S. Air Force. I did a couple of combat tours, two in Afghanistan early in the conflict, and then another in Iraq. And then most recently have served as a commander in the Iowa Air National Guard, where we commanded some operations flying off the coast of Russia, looking to deter Moscow aggression and what now unfortunately has become a horrible situation in Ukraine. But once I came back, my wife and I, we got married. She had two kids. When we were married, we had two kids together, and just this December, we are very fortunate.
Congratulations.
We got two little foster kids in. So they range from 15 down to a new two-year-old. And one of the things about service is we've continued to serve in the military, but we felt like we could do a lot of good for our community. So our first race in 2014, first time we'd ever run for elected office, we decided to run for the State House. And that was because this is where the community that had raised Kelly, my wife, and I had served. And we saw some things that we really wanted to get back to basics, taking care of our kids, balancing the budget, making sure that, you know, more of the money that we were bringing home went back to our family. And so we ran in that race. It was East Polk County. And Caleb, as you'll remember, East Polk County was a place where Republicans did not run. Mm-hmm. It had kind of been just chopped off and left to the Democrats. And so we thought we would work really hard knocking on everybody's door, Republican, Democrat, Independent, even my mother-in-law, hardcore Democrat, and we were able to win that first race by, you know, 12 percentage points. We became the whip in the House, chair of the judiciary, assistant majority leader in our first couple of years, and then went on to run in the state Senate. We took on Jasper County, which had been kind of old school Maytag employees, but had just a really great sense of community, and these were folks who cared about family. They cared about keeping more of their wages. They cared about their constitutional rights, including their Second Amendment rights. We ran in that race, and we won by just about 24 percentage points. So doubled what we'd done before, really kind of moved us in the right direction as to helping win back a legislature that was truly responsive to its electorate. Basically, the bosses of the people who get sent down there into the Senate, into the House, that they are answerable to those folks and that they deliver for them. And that's kind of what we've been about ever since. We run to win, we work hard, even in Democratic districts, but more important than winning is delivering once you get up to those august legislative bodies.
And during the time in the legislature, even up till us keeping it, you guys have done a lot here in the state of Iowa that's been really great for our state. Can you just talk about the major focus points that you had be able to accomplish?
Yeah, so I've been very proud to be on Ways and Means Committee. In this area, we have cut taxes for Iowans three times in my 8 years in the legislature. We brought down property taxes. We have worked hard to consolidate mental health in the state so that we have regionalized mental health in a much more productive way. And it's an important issue for you, Caleb, but also for so much of rural Iowa to have access to it while buying down the property rate. We've eliminated the death tax. This is so that families, we have 87,000 plus Iowa farmers across here that are family owned. And so often when the senior family member died and they tried to give it on to their kids, they were paying a massive amount in taxes to transfer that. And it was crushing small farms. Because while they had, you know, money in the field, that was not money that they could liquidate to be able to pay a large tax burden. And so these farms were disappearing. We eliminated that death tax and helped farmers be able to keep their farms while at the same time investing in what we call new farmer tax credits to get new folks into this program. And it's been very successful. One of the ones I think is the biggest is trying to eliminate the retirement tax on Iowans. We have so many great family members who have spent their life here in Iowa. We want to make sure they get to keep that money that they have spent a lifetime accumulating and stay in Iowa. Because while we'd love to see them go to Florida and Arizona for the winter, we would more importantly, we want to have them come back here and be part of our communities as grandparents, as productive members of our neighborhoods and our families. And then one thing that I think we continue to work on, but I've been very successful, we went from being one of the highest income tax states in the country, which was really driving young families out of the state. And we took that from about 9% down to 3.9%. So that is a massive, almost two-thirds cut. We are still working forward on this and hope to get an elimination of the income tax here in Iowa, because that's a great way to reward families who are working and trying hard to make things successful for their kids by letting them keep that money in their family, their main streets, on their farms, and in their community. And here's a real success story. It's great to cut taxes, but it's more important to see what happens with the economy for all of us. And Iowa was one of the first states to recover from the pandemic because of these tax cut measures. We invested in people, not in the powers of government. We went forward and we saw Iowa be one of the best managed states by U.S. News and World Report. We have seen Iowa continue to be one of the most solvent states in the entire country. And so I'm very proud that with our small budget in the state of Iowa, $8 billion, that's a B, not a T like the federal government, the $3 trillion they just spent. This is $8 billion that we fund our schools. Every year that I've been in there, we have funded our schools with a funding increase over the course of the last 8 years. We support our law enforcement. We passed the best Back the Blue bill in the country. This is now something that other states are modeling themselves after. I wish the federal government would follow what we've done here in Iowa.
You and me both.
That's right, exactly. To protect our law enforcement, as well as make sure our cops and our communities can cooperate and work hand in hand. And as a result of these, you know, fiscal policies and social policies, we have seen Iowa be really successful. And this is a good playbook, not just for other states, but Caleb, to your point, this is a playbook now that Washington could learn from and be successful across the board. And so I'll end it with this. One of the proudest things I think we've done is we've also balanced the budget every single year. We never intentionally underfunded things. We didn't raise taxes to pay for, you know, one-time expenses, as we're seeing in Washington right now. We've said we're going to build a budget that fulfills our long-term commitments to our schools, our communities, our cops. And we've done it successfully. At a point now, with the tax cuts, we have returned money back to Iowans. They've grown the economy. We have a full rainy day fund. So if there's an emergency like a derecho or a flood or avian flu, we can be able to protect that. And that's to the tune of $1 billion. We have a full reserve fund, so ongoing operational expenses, and we still have more revenue coming in than what we have obligations for. So, you know, in Washington, they're a tax and spend type of government. Every penny they get in, that's a penny they're taking out of your pocket, and they're immediately spending it, usually on things that are going to cost 10 pennies going forward, but they don't have the way to fund that. In Iowa, we have done a great job of saying, unless we absolutely need it, let's give that money back to an Iowan, and they'll do a much better job growing the economy than anything the government could do. So that's a great model to follow. I'm very proud of that. And that's just a very top tip of the iceberg of what we've done in our 8 years up in the legislature.
Wow. And you guys continue to do great work, and I'm actually really proud to be an Iowan, so.
Good. Well, we're proud to have you here. I mean, this is what family's all about, right? I always say, you know, every town in Iowa is a small town, but the reality is that, you know, every community across the country is really an Iowa community at heart. We have a lot in common. We work better when we're working together.
Speaking of Iowa communities and that, there's this saying in Iowa called Iowa Nice.
Yes.
And, something I want to touch on real quick is we all knew what happened with the news and everything with what happened in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
With our current with the current administration leaving Americans behind.
Yeah.
Now, going after the Iowa Nice motto, you did something that was awesome. And I'll let you talk a little bit about that. But how was that experience? And is this something that we should be doing in the near future for protecting Americans?
Yeah, Caleb, so great question. And this is, you know, a year ago, I've done several tours in support of operations around the world. But Afghanistan was a situation where the United States went in, you know, 2 decades ago, basically my adult professional life. We had served with allies in the region, both from around the globe as well as those in Afghanistan. We had gotten young families to be a successful place so that girls could actually go to school and learn, that, you know, terrorist groups were no longer embedded in the country, and that we weren't seeing the type of just draconian measures where people were having their hands chopped off for practicing things like Christianity in the country. Unfortunately, we decided that we were going to do a full-scale withdrawal and abandon the country about a year ago last month. And in that massive evacuation that was not well-planned, I would offer, we made 13 Gold Star families. And that's a tragic situation because we had 13 Marines, soldiers, and Navy corpsmen, or the docs of the Navy, who died as a result of a poorly executed and arguably fully failed withdrawal plan. We put 18-year-olds on the front line in a battle rattle to be able to protect an airport with no idea who was supposed to be in and who was not allowed to come in. And while the U.S. government was effective in getting 70,000 individuals out of Afghanistan in a week, we still have a hard time understanding which of those individuals were actually supposed to be evacuated versus which ones just got their way onto a plane. And in that chaos, a country that we spent 2 decades, you know, defending, supporting, and putting a lot of U.S. Treasure and even more U.S. blood into protecting, we watched it collapse over the course of 10 days. And left in the country were people, including U.S. citizens, including allies who had served with us, including folks who were, you know, Christian missionaries that had been working with us in the field. Those folks were all abandoned. And when the flag came down over Karzai International Airport at the end of August, there opened up a window for a group of volunteers to come forward and try and save the Americans still left in the country that the U.S. State Department said they just basically could not get to. So we organized this group called Task Force Argo. It was developed from about 100 military volunteers. I'm proud to be the chair of this organization. I work with another guy who is an Army Ranger. He is the president. And we have an executive group of Marines and intelligence officers who were from all over the world and all walks of life, but Americans who wanted to do the right thing. We were able to get together and evacuate just about 3,000 individuals, a large portion of them U.S. citizens and their immediate family, and provided 5 aircraft to fly into Mazar Sharif, a city in the north of Afghanistan, where we worked with allies on the ground to be able to evacuate these folks from Kabul to do an overland caravan in the dead of night, protecting their families and getting them out of country. I remember vividly the story of Mr. Soleimani. He was an engineer, and he was trying to evacuate his family. He worked for the U.S. Embassy. He was promised evacuation. He went to the gate, Abbey Gate. The explosion happened. There was chaos. He was blown away from his family on the opposite side of the road. He tried to get back to his family, and the Taliban caught him. And they said, "What did you do for the Americans?" And he said, "I'm an engineer for our country." They said, "What is an engineer?" He's like, "I build things so that our country can be successful." And without hesitation, they took a machete and tried to chop off his hand. He was able to get away, and they said, "You will never build anything again," and then shot him through the legs and left him to die in the middle of the street in front of his family. So it was a warning to others. He was able to get away. His wife and his kids helped pull him into a ditch, and once they had left, they made contact with us, and we helped to evacuate him. In fact, he ended up being the lead pilot car to travel north. He was the senior man on the ground who helped evacuate in that first tranche about 80 people. But before he left Kabul, we asked him if he would help evacuate these two twin sisters who had been left in Kabul. On Monday, they went to school and they were allowed to go and learn at the college. And by the middle of that week, the Taliban had rounded up everybody at the university and said women will be confined to their rooms, and if they leave, they will be either beaten, executed, or they'll be forced into marriage with the Taliban. These women rightfully were frightened. They made contact with us, and they needed a male escort. And so we asked the senior man, who had just been brutally attacked, if he would be willing to serve as their male guardian as they traveled the 8 hours north to Mazar Sharif. And I'm proud to say that his bravery was indicative of all of these individuals. They had spent 20 years helping America. They were going to help their fellow countrymen. And so he evacuated them. They loaded in the back of the Toyota Corolla. They were the pilot car for two mini buses that we followed up with. They went through over a dozen Taliban checkpoints to the north, saying that they were going to visit family. We got them to the Mazar Sharif Airport, and we evacuated. I'm very happy to say he now lives and is becoming a U.S. citizen in Florida, and those two girls survived, and they are now in Texas. And we have the family of my interpreter, who Nabi Mohammadi, who made it here to Iowa. And Nabi is now a U.S. citizen, and his family is in the process of becoming U.S. citizens. These, again, are people who were promised the ability to become U.S. citizens when they were back in Afghanistan. They'd already been vetted, they'd been cleared, but unfortunately they were left behind by the U.S. government. So while it was a dark chapter, Caleb, for the U.S. government, it was a very bright chapter for U.S. citizens who stood up to do the right thing to save, you know, again, the dozens and dozens and dozens of U.S. citizens who'd been abandoned in their families. But we continue the fight today. We've got multiple Catholic nuns that we are supporting who are in hiding in Afghanistan today because they couldn't get out. We still have U.S. citizens who are in Afghanistan today who cannot get out because they have a loved one who's injured, or young girls who can't be evacuated, that they don't want those girls turned into sex slaves or child brides of the Taliban. So a salute to those brave individuals still in country. There's clearly much more the U.S. government has to do to make that right.
And the second part of my question for that is, what do you think would be the best way for us to be able to protect those Americans? What solution do you think that the federal government should try to work on to make sure that American citizens in other countries are protected?
Yeah, so I think we should always, one, know where our U.S. citizens are when they're over there. And if there's going to be a pre-planned evacuation, that we've given them the heads up so that they have the ability to get to places like the airport or be alerted ahead of time. Equally, if there is a tragic situation on the ground, Task Force Argo was named after what happened in the 1979 revolution in Iran, where the U.S. Embassy was overrun. And as a result, we did not have the ability to get those Americans out. So as we go forward, we should be able to have, and I worked this in the intelligence community, NEOs, or emergency evacuation operation plans, so that we can get U.S. citizens out if something like this happens. But you know what? As opposed to evacuating U.S. citizens all over the world, the United States can and should be a leader in making sure that the world is a safe and stable place. And we do that by not allowing autocrats, whether they be in, you know, Afghanistan or in Moscow or in Beijing or in Tehran, get to define the terms of U.S. national security. We have the opportunity to identify what is in America's best interests. We should be prepared to stand to protect those interests, and we should ensure that American citizens and U.S. national security is always a top priority. And if that means staring down Putin in Moscow and telling him, no, this is wrong, you're a threat, or President Xi in Beijing and telling him, you will not invade Taiwan, not only do we have U.S. citizens there, but we have U.S. national interests there, then we need to be able to have the deterrence power that comes not only through a strong military, but through a strong America to make sure that happens.
All right. So thank you very much for that. That was actually inspiring that we do need to work harder to make sure that Americans are protected.
Yes, Caleb, I fully agree with you.
All right. So now let's go ahead and talk about the election coming up here within the next 7 days. You are running for the congressional district for the 3rd district here in Iowa against Cindy Axne.
Yeah.
What made you decide to go ahead and run for the U.S. congressional seat?
Caleb, well, first off, you're right. We're 1 week out. This is exciting. This is one of the top races in the country. I think all eyes of America are on Iowa's 3rd district. This is basically Polk and Dallas County. We've got a little bit of green to the north, all the way down to the southern border with Missouri here in Iowa. And we've got great people in this community. It's not only a reflection of Iowa, both urban, suburban, and rural. It's really a reflection of the entire country, this kind of great mix of diversity and ways of life. I got excited about this because this is my hometown. I mean, this is where we grew up. This is where we've lived our whole life. This community has been fantastic to us. We want to do the right thing by our community and try and serve. We also want to recognize that, families like mine have been hurting. Families like yours have felt the financial hardships of the last 2 years. We went from a country that was energy independent to a country that's dependent on foreign oil. We went from a country that had some of its best economic times ever to some of the highest inflation in my lifetime. And we went from a country that supported parents and our law enforcement to now a country where they tried to close the schools and cops aren't allowed on campuses right here in Polk County. That's a bad situation to be in. I think that there have been self-inflicted wounds these past 2 years by bad policy choices being made in D.C. that have had an outsized impact on Iowans here in our hometowns. So I think we can right this ship pretty directly. One, let's get energy independence back. It's a national security issue. We have the ability. Iowa leads the way. Biofuels, biodiesel, and all of the above solution, including renewables, they can be successful. Let's make a country that is safer by having cops and communities who work together, not who see each other as adversaries. And we need to move forward on that directly. And then let's make sure that we have an economic policy that is advantageous. And that means things like the basics, balancing the budget, not spending more than we take in, limiting the size of the federal government. Don't hire 87,000 new tax agents and tell me that that's going to help grow the economy. You're just going to tax your way to trying to cover it. Don't hand out $20,000 loan forgiveness to people when everyone else has done it the right way and worked hard. Let's make sure that we're spending our money with a purpose, not trying to curry votes or favor with small segments of the electorate. And I think we can do this by being fair, but being consistent across the board. And it's Congress's job to hold those purse strings. It's in Article 1 of the Constitution. Congress is supposed to be the one setting the budget, not the president through executive order deciding what he's going to spend money on. We have an obligation to hold ourselves, to hold our presidency, and to hold our country accountable, because ultimately, we all are working for the voters of the 3rd District. And that's what I'm very excited to have the opportunity to do, is be a ardent fighter for Iowans in Washington. And whether it's a Republican or a Democrat in leadership, I will always put our constituents' voices first in whatever policy issues we're dealing with. I've done it here in the Iowa legislature for the last 8 years. I absolutely will be doing it in Washington, D.C.
Well, I'm very excited that you are running. What are major topics that you already addressed some of them, but what are the main issues that you're hearing from Iowans, and what are the main issues that you think you'll be able to bring to the table in Congress if you are elected?
Yeah, so I think Iowa has the opportunity to lead in going from, three members of the congressional delegation there in the minority that have no voice. By turning this seat, we will have 4 members of the Iowa congressional delegation that are in the majority and get to drive things. So whether you're Ashley Hinson on appropriations and you want to make sure that we are investing your tax dollars effectively, she's going to have a voice in that. Whether you're Marionette Miller Meeks, who is probably going to serve on energy and commerce, and you want an energy program that makes America energy independent, she gets the voice to do that. Whether you are Randy Feenstra on Ways and Means and you think the best way to grow the economy is to watch spending and cut taxes, he gets to lead on that. And we are very privileged. We would like to serve, wherever the people of Iowa want us. But if we have the opportunity to serve on places like the Ag Committee, we have a farm bill coming up. We want to be able to protect our farmers and secure it. We also think that we have an opportunity to serve in an international capacity to hold China accountable on dangerous things like synthetic drugs called fentanyl. They're coming in through the southern border. Let's take a full approach on this. Hold China accountable, secure the southern border, and find an immigration policy for folks who want to come here the right way to be successful. If we can tackle those things with a majority in Iowa, we will have done a world of good, not just for our state, but for the entire country.
And you've actually been to the border.
Yes, sir.
And people sometimes see it as this, there's not major problems, and they just try to sugarcoat it. But you've been there. Explain a little bit what you've seen at the border, why we need to protect the border more, and what solutions can you do if you're elected as U.S. Congress for Iowa to help make sure that our border is secure.
Yeah, so this is an area where I think there's absolute border security challenges. One, it's a national security threat, and it's a humanitarian challenge. And we should be, as Iowans, which we are, compassionate about folks who want to find a better life for themselves. And we have several on-ramps to be able to afford that. The federal government could do a much better job making sure that people who want to come here legally have the ability to do that. The problem is that we have a no-deterrence plan on the southern border that's allowed 4 million people in the last 2 years to come here illegally. We have over 1 million people who have come here that are full-on gotaways. We don't even know where they are in the country. The cartels of Central America know better where these individuals are and are using them as modern-day slave labor in the U.S. Than the U.S. government does. And that's just the ones we know got away. There's arguably far more that have escaped into the country, including, you know, we caught 77 individuals on the terrorist watch list last year, even several more this year. This is the challenge. Those are the ones we caught. What about the ones we haven't caught or didn't know about and now are operating in the United States with impunity? So here's what I would recommend. We have the opportunity to secure the border just as we did when I was a National Guardsman flying operations off the coast of Mexico, to be able to deter individuals from 160 countries walking across the southern border with no real restriction. That's both a physical barrier, like a wall. It's a technology barrier that is able to track people, but it's also a fully funded Customs and Border Patrol, one of the most diverse, you know, elements within the U.S. government today. They're defending their communities because they live right there, and they want to make sure that first-generation immigrants aren't outpaced by the illegal immigrants that are coming here behind them. So we've got some really good ways that we can do this. The humanitarian disaster is twofold. One, people are being exploited to come here. They're basically paying a fee to a trafficker who then uses them again as a serf on the U.S. side to exploit them. They're also holding their families back home hostage. The drug problem is unprecedented. We have a surge of very deadly fentanyl. When I was at the border, came into contact with a Customs and Border Patrol agent who identified an individual with a backpack, 2 pounds of Chinese-made synthetic fentanyl in that backpack. Caleb, that's enough to kill 500,000 Iowans. That's the entire city of Des Moines dead in one backpack.
Wow.
So this is a real weapons of mass destruction. It's a direct threat to U.S. national security, and it's a threat to every single county in my district. It is now a border county, because in this situation, fentanyl kills more people in the age of 18 to 43 than anything else out there today. So it is a direct threat coming from a foreign entity. We have a responsibility to stop it. I wish the vice president, I wish my opponent would actually go down there, see the border themselves, and come up with solutions rather than pretending this doesn't happen, because it absolutely matters. Thank you so much, Caleb.
Mm-hmm. Another big hot topic for you, a big hot topic issue. The Roe v. Wade got overturned by the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's woken both sides, awakened both sides of the aisle to see you have one side fighting for abortion to protect it. You have the other side who wants to try to find other solutions than abortion.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to your constituents that you would be able to protect abortion? You would, my mistake, that you would be able to...
Well, let me just say, I'm a pro-life guy. So, you know, I want to always be able to protect life, both the life of the mother and the life of the baby.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
That's important. No, and I hear where you're coming with that. I think, you know, the Dobbs case identified under Article 10 of the Constitution, the 10th Amendment, that it goes back to the states. So at this point, I would fight against Democrats or Republicans who try and overreach at the federal level and try and do, again, what my opponent did was to say that we're going to federalize this issue and try and codify a bill that goes well beyond where Roe ever was and say an abortion on demand, taxpayer funded situation would be the law of the land and Congress is going to be the one to move that forward. I find that reprehensible. It was not done in conversation with Iowans. Let's give this back to Iowans and find rational places for this. There are those, you know, we voted on two bills. One, we said no late-term abortions here in Iowa. It's still the law of the land, except for in the case of the health of the mother, meaning that the mother was going to die. And then we don't want to see situations where we're putting my wife, you know, our sisters, our brothers in a situation where they would have to make those hard choices and in one life to try and save another. At the same time, we also have said, you know, in the extremely rare situation of rape or incest, we want to be able to have a conversation and consultation with the doctor there. But we need to remember, this is not just a conversation between a woman and her doctor. This is also a conversation about the future of that child, and that needs to be taken into consideration. So let's provide some clear guidelines. Let's listen to Iowans on this issue. But at the federal level, this is one of those things that I think the voters in every state need to have their voice heard before a couple of folks in Washington try and make a rule that would impact every single person in America.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on my podcast today.
Caleb, thank you for having me. This is excellent. I appreciate your work on this front.
All right. And remember, if you guys have not voted yet, you can still vote early in person at your local auditor's office, or there are satellite locations being put up. You can look at your local auditor's office to find those. And, of course, the election on November 8th. Make sure that you get your voice heard. Thank you guys for tuning in. I hope you guys have a wonderful day. And may God bless you, God bless the great state of Iowa, and God bless the United States of America.